From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
Ho! It's another Christmas song. Whoa! Get ready, brother, for another Christmas song. They play for a month ad infinitum. One day it struck me, someone must write them. So, it's
that's
another
a selection
Christmas
from the
song.
Grammy-nominated A Colbert Christmas. The songs were penned by David Javerbaum. He's the former head writer and executive producer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He's written songs for a Tony-nominated musical and co-authored the best-selling America, the Book. And now he has a new book out of his own. It's a parody of all those guides for new parents, this one written from the fetus's point of view. It's called What to Expect When You're Expected. We'll talk with David Javerbaum after this.
Download them. Pay for another Christmas song. Chestnuts glisten on a silent night. Sleigh bells kissing by candlelight.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Parents expecting their first child are usually eager to devour any new parenting guide that will decipher what lies ahead. But what about a few tips for the soon-to-be-born baby? Who's writing a guide for them? Into the breach, so to speak, steps David Javerbaum, the Emmy Award-winning former head writer and executive producer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. His new book is called What to Expect When You're Expected, a prenatal guide from the fetus's point of view. This isn't David Javerbaum's first time poking at various conventions. He used to write headlines for the satirical newspaper The Onion. He co-authored the best-selling America, the Book, penned songs for Stephen Colbert's Christmas special, which just got nominated for a Grammy, and still contributes to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart as a producer. And David Javerbaum joins us this morning from New York. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you join us. What prompted you to poke fun? Was it your own experience as a parent that you wanted to sort of poke at all of those parenting guides?
There's a culture pervasive out there, you know, in pregnancy culture that I saw, you know, just from the two pregnancies that my wife and I had who shared, that it prompts fear and anxiety, and I thought it would be fun to undercut that, and just, it'd be a funny thing to parody.
Is there I want to just look up one thing that you say early in the book that I thought was particularly funny about the way in which this goes forward, and it's typical the tone of the book when you're talking about how the book is already just such an amazing success and you write. But I was even more excited by the letters and emails I received from thousands of pre and newborns. Many expressed gratitude, not merely for the book, but for the discovery that they were not alone, that other human beings were also going through the same strange and at times bewildering process of being born. There were also a few marriage proposals. These were disturbing.
Yes, it was a very intense experience, the whole thing. But like I said, you know, and I'm totally sincere when I wrote that, just knowing that I've changed, I've changed the lives of fetuses who, you know, feel better about themselves now. I feel really good about that.
You give us, among other things, a sample genome. I'm going to read just a couple of my favorites, and then you can chime in with a few of yours. But these are looking at, you know, that little strand of DNA and what you can learn about it. And one you say is, if you look at this, you can tell that this is someone who's going to unscrew Oreos before eating them. Another will tell you that this person's going to have a 640 verbal and 520 math. And my particular favorite, hair, curly brown, eyes, hazel. Bats right, throws left. So how about what others are favorites of yours in terms of what you can find out early on about this process?
I'll read this verbatim. There's one genome that tells you that the child will be born able to do this one trick with his elbows that used to be kind of cool but now just seems stupid, but not even stupid enough to get on Letterman. But he still does it at parties when he's had enough to drink and thinks it's entertaining, but everybody's seen it before and it's just embarrassing.
We can take turns reading here. Here's from chapter 2. Unborn babies have always worried, hence their fetal position. What they worry about, however, has changed considerably over the generations. Hundreds of years ago, your four fetuses worried that a slap on mommy's belly might leave them to have a hand-shaped birthmark, or that her penchant for bananas would turn them into gorillas. The march of science proved these fears wrong and treatable, respectively. And that is, I mean, the last part really is true. I mean, what did you find particularly humorous when you were going through those guidebooks about the sort of fears that parents have about if they do just the wrong thing, something else is going to happen to their baby?
Well, it's just something where they'll mentions something like, it's very unlikely that your child will be born with three heads. And then you go, what, wait a minute, wait, there's a chance that would happen? And then, so, you know, it serves to actually alarm you, but it's in the guise of scaring you. But honestly, I mean, you know, those books are popular for a reason, and, you know, it is a naturally anxious time, so I'm not really poking fun with any malice at all. I'm sort of, you know, making jokes about the entire situation.
Turn, if you would, David, to page 92 of the book, Around the World in 40 Weeks. This is your sort of guide to what fetuses are having to contend with in every nation on Earth. Read, if you would, let's see, why don't you read China, Israel, and Panama?
Yeah, well, these are little, you know, oddities of the birthing process or birth customs in various countries. So in China, the Apgar test consists mainly of balance beam and floor exercises.
Israel?
In Israel, the fetuses are continually hounded by their mothers for, quote, never calling, end quote.
And Panama?
In Panama, the birth canals are exceptionally long and owned by the government.
And Russia, vodka births increasingly common. Switzerland, due date includes hour, minute, and second. And Vatican City, new pregnancies greeted with a mix of shock and covert pride. What has been the reaction to the book so far?
The reaction, you know, a lot of people are getting good comments about it. People think it's funny. I'm certainly very pleased with it. And, you know, I'm hoping it was a book that was written hopefully to, you know, to be an evergreen. It's not a topical thing. Obviously, pregnancy always happens. So I'm hoping that it will remain as popular, you know, for as long as the thing that I blatantly ripped off remains popular.
David Jeberbaum, our guest this hour. I should say David Jeberbaum, GED, which is how you're listed on the cover of the book. The book's called What to Expect When You're Expected, A Fetus's Guide to the First Three Trimesters. David Jeberbaum also has worked with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. He penned the songs for The Colbert Christmas, just nominated for a Grammy. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much.
And also put out the best-selling book, America, the Book, which you co-authored and edited along with Jon Stewart. What are you busy with now, David? I want to go through all of those things that you've been working with, but you seem sort of insanely prolific, going from one thing to the next. So I'm sure you're already engaged with a new creative project. What might that be?
Well, I have a screenplay that I'm trying to sell and all the usual things along those lines, you know, that I'm hopeful about for next year. But I'm still at The Daily Show, and actually the main thing I'm working on at the moment is there's going to be a sequel to America the Book coming out next year.
Oh, well, we'll look forward to that. Let's pay a little attention, though, to your musical attributes. We're going to hear in a moment some selections from the Colbert Christmas special, The Greatest Gift of All, which was just nominated for Best Comedy Album, Grammy nomination for Best Comedy Album. Tell us something about the creation of that, because it seems like, again, such a perfect send-up of another genre. Your current book is a send-up of parenting guides. This seems to be one of those sort of things that go back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, the Christmas special with Perry Como or Dinah Shore. What prompted you to put together this particular idea along with Stephen Colbert?
Stephen and I kind of simultaneously, because we know each other from The Daily Show, and he wanted to do a Christmas special, I wanted to write Christmas songs, and it just worked out perfectly. And it was a real meeting. I mean, as I knew it would be with Stephen, it was a real meeting of the minds, and it was a joy to work with him. And so we wrote a lot of songs, and we were able to attract people, the celebrities, to be in it, and it was an incredibly hard feat of production for them because they had to do it while they were doing their regular show. But it came off great, I was very proud of the results and the songs, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. But it's easy for me to say all I have to do is write the songs. He has to actually produce the thing. It's very, very hard.
And this is something you received training in. I mean, this is not just something.
Yeah, I went to graduate school at NYU for musical theater writing. Actually, so I actually have a master's degree in this thing for some odd reason.
And you also had a musical on Broadway last year that got a Tony nomination.
Yeah, I wrote a show called Cry Baby, or the lyrics for the show called Cry Baby, based on the John Waters movie, and that got a Tony nomination for Best Musical. Although there's six musicals eligible, and four of them get nominated, so I always say it means I was not in the bottom two.
Well, let's hear part of a song. We're going to listen first to the Willie Nelson song that was done for the Colbert Christmas. This is called Little Dealer Boy.
Yet do not spurn my gift completely.
three wise men please demur. Behold a plant that smokes more sweetly than either frankincense or myrrh. And like the child born in this manger, this herb is mild, yet it is strong. And it brings peace to friend and stranger. Goodwill to men lies in this balm. And now my wonder weed is flaring.
Are you high?
Lit like that special star above.
Can it be?
Pass it around and in the sherry
on Christmas Day.
And let not mankind bogart love.
You'd smoke my tree.
Willie Nelson singing Little Dealer Boy, lyrics by David Javerbaum. How did people like Willie Nelson respond to, in a sense, sort of doing parodies of themselves?
Well, they all understood that they were, they were parodies, but they weren't mean-spirited. And they all actually had a really good time, and they're all in it for Colbert. They all love Colbert. I mean, they're all besotted with him. So Willie Nelson was actually a little bit concerned that this song would be perceived as blasphemous, but it's not. It's obviously a very, very sweet song. And they're all terrific to work with, and they all came in like totally prepared, and they were able to like tape their scenes pretty quickly because of their preparation.
Yeah, in some ways, I probably should not have used the word parody because that does convey a sort of jab to it. And it really isn't that kind of program. There is. It seems funny to use the word sweet with something that's associated with Stephen Colbert, perhaps, but it is. There is that sort of – there's a kind of warmth to the songs and to the program, do you think?
Yeah, well, the one that I'm certainly proudest of is the one with Elvis Costello that was nominated for for best song, Much Worse Things to Believe In. That was written. Stephen said he wanted something that was, more pensive and less cynical, and that was the right call. So I knew, he'd be in, and Elvis would be in, and it just, it seemed like a really good lyric to write.
Well, we'll pull that up in just a moment. We're going to get that organized and get that on so that we can listen to that, because it does have a nice message to it. But there's some humor in it as well. And as soon as we get that ready to play, we'll take a listen to that. But let's listen to something else first. Just sort of set the stage for those people not familiar with Toby Keith. Describe who he is and what his songs are like, and then we'll listen to that particular song.
Toby Keith is the ultra patriotic country singer who responded with I'll put a boot in your fist a boot in your ass to the terrorists after 9/11, and I forget the name of that song he did that was parodied, it was based on, but in any case he came in, and this is a song that's taking the whole Bill O'Reilly war on Christmas and getting very 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 militant about it.
Toby Keith, Have I Got a Present for You?
Believe what Christmas has come to today. All these atheists and judges trying to take it away. No carols in our public schools, no trees at City Hall. And they wish you season's greetings at the shopping mall. Ain't you sick of it all? Well, there's a war on Christmas, it's under attack. But this year America's taking it back. Separate church and state, that's what some lawyer said. I say it's time we separated him from his head. You can call me unchristian, but that's not true. Cause if I got a present for you, it's a thought that counts.
Toby Keith singing Have I Got a Present for You. What I love about that song is that if this wasn't played with the context that we're giving it, don't you think you could easily hear that on country radio today?
That was consciously written for that purpose. It was consciously written so that it worked no matter either side of the issues you were coming from. And I was very proud of that song because it came out on that level where people who agree with that sentiment, can rally behind that song.
Yeah, and what did Toby Keith think of it?
He has a good sense of humor. He's not... despite his image, like he's not this mindless, arch conservative guy. He's a very smart guy, and he got the joke, and he was really into it. He thought it was really funny. He did a great job in the special.
And in terms of how people were to work with, you were saying before that they all love Stephen, and they were all eager to participate. And you've got a great, difference of musical styles, everything from Toby Keith to John Legend. So was that part of the intent as well, to sort of make sure that you sort of covered A to Z in terms of both musical styles and the kind of way in which people come across to their particular fans?
Yeah, it was probably a matter of booking and who was available for the taping weeks. But there's also, but there's also partly, there are a few people who committed in advance. I know John Legend had, and Elvis Costello had, and some people that we just booked, relatively recently, but it was a song, sort of ready to go for all of them. I mean, there were a lot more lyrics that I had that we didn't use.
Let's go back and listen to the song that you said you were particularly proud of, the one that was nominated, and it's called There Are Much Worse Things to Believe In. This is Elvis Costello and Stephen Colbert.
There are cynics, there are skeptics, there are legions of dispassionate dyspeptics who regard this time of year as a maudlin, insincere, cheesy, crass, commercial travesty of all that we hold dear.
When they think that, well, I can hear it, but I pity them, their lack of Christmas spirit. For in a world like ours, take it from Stephen, there are much worse things to believe in.
A redeemer and a savior and a beast man giving toys for good behavior.
The faith in what might be and the hope that we might see the answer to all sorrow in a box beneath the tree. Find them foolish,
sentimental.
Well, you're clearly none too bright,
so we'll be gentle.
Don't even try to start vaguely conceiving of all the much worse things to believe in. Believe in the judgment, believe in jihad.
Elvis Costello and Stephen Colbert singing There Are Much Worse Things to Believe In, lyrics by David Jeverbaum, who joins us this hour. I think my favorite line, David, is a redeemer, a savior, an obese man who gives gifts for good behavior. How about yours?
That's a clever rhyme. I think the whole sentiment of the song, which is that, like, you can kid about it, but there are much worse things to believe in than all the stuff about Christmas and Santa Claus and goodwill on earth and everything like that. And I like the message of the whole song.
And how difficult was it to get, we're going to listen to this in a moment, the duet that Jon Stewart sings with Stephen Colbert. Was that a harder act to sell, or was Jon eager to do it?
John, I had something else written about Hanukkah that I thought I knew. John said he would do a song about Hanukkah with Stephen. That was a natural, and I'd written a song, but it was very much more, had a much more Yiddishy feel, and it had much more of a ba-dum-bum kind of song. And John didn't want that. John wanted something that, again, was a little bit more heartfelt, and he was absolutely right. So he wanted came up with a dialogue between him and Stephen that was sort of a way to bridge the faiths, but only with some partial success.
Here it is. Can I interest you in Hanukkah?
Can I interest you in Hanukkah? Maybe something in a festival of lights. It's a sensible alternative to Christmas. And it lasts for seven, for you, eight, nine.
Hanukkah, huh? I've never really thought about it.
Well, you could do worse.
Is it merry?
It's kind of merry.
Is it cheery?
It's got some cheer.
Is it jolly?
Look, I wouldn't know from jolly, but it's not my least unfavorite time of year.
When's it start?
On the 25th.
Of December?
Kislev.
Which is when exactly?
I will check.
Are there presents?
Yes, indeed, 8 days of presents, which means one nice one, then a week of trek.
Does Hanukkah? Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert from Can I Interest You in Hanukkah. Did you know they could both sing before you started this project, David?
Yeah, well, I knew that Stephen could sing very well, and I knew that Jon could not sing very well, and that, and he was happy to say that. So, yeah, I knew that going in.
And what about who you didn't get? I read something about one group in particular that you really wish you could have included.
Oh, Metallica?
Right.
Yeah. Well, my idea was just very simply to have Metallica on as Metallica and take their song Enter Sandman and make it Enter Santa and just have them sing about, like, what a wonderful holiday it was, but sing it like they sing that song.
Will there be a Colbert Christmas sequel in which Metallica might be heard?
I would love there to be one. If Metallica is listening, I would love to do that. It would be so cool.
I'm sure they're big public radio consumers.
I'm sure they're huge public radio fans, especially in San Francisco.
David Javerbaum joins us this hour. His new book is called What to Expect When You're Expected, A Fetus's Guide to the First Three Trimesters. He also, as you've been hearing, penned the songs for the Colbert Christmas special and has also worked extensively with Jon Stewart in the past on The Daily Show. You were executive producer and head writer. Describe what you're doing now, actually, with The Daily Show, David.
My title is consulting producer, which means like I'm the old man who walks around kind of saying, in my day, it used to be funnier. Kind of what I do there now, but I'm there like work. You know, coming up with ideas for the show about 4 hours a day, and it's been a lot of my afternoons. You know, working on this this book that we're getting ready for next year.
The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, of course, has become such a phenomenon. We have to take a short break in just a moment, but you've often heard, of course, the cited figure that he and the Pew survey done last year was the number 4 rated journalist or the most. I guess the fourth most trusted journalist was the way the phrasing of the survey went. Just a quick thought from you, and then we'll come back and talk about that more, about his particular gift, his particular popularity, and what you think is at the root of that and the crazy time in which we live.
Well, there's a lot of positive attributes he has that, you know, it's all of them working together. I mean, I think the biggest thing is that he's a very likable person, and he really is exactly the person you see on the show, and you get the sense that he's a no BS person. And knowing him, I can tell you that's true. There's, you know, he's just an absolutely great person, and that comes through. I think that's above and beyond the fact that he has good material and he's, you know, incredibly intelligent. And we have good people, you know, working to help him, and you know, it's really kind of coalesced very well.
And there's also a real intensity to him. I was just, you know, watching, not last night's, but the night before show, which we made this, you know, spoof of the latest Tea Party protests in Washington. And beneath all the humor, there's a real intensity.
Yeah, what you need is you have to have a real, you know, passion, a real point of view, a real thought about something, or an observation about the absurdity of something. And then starting with that, and then you should make it funny. And on those occasions when John winds up saying something that comes off as sort of didactic and not very funny, it's a failure on our part, and we need to, you know, try to, you know, work on that for next time, because we are a comedy show.
David Javerbaum, our guest this hour, consulting producer to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, also penned the songs for the Colbert Christmas, The Greatest Gift of All, recently nominated for a Grammy Award, and has a new book out, Guide for the Expected. It's called What to Expect When You're Expected, A Fetus's Guide to the First Three Trimesters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll open up our phone lines and you can join our conversation. If you have a question you'd like to pose, especially if you're a fetus, perhaps, you can call us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. And you can also go to our website at kqed.org and participate in our comments section there online. So all of those options available to you. We'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, David Javerbaum, GED, author of a new book called What to Expect When You're Expected, A Fetus's Guide to the First Three Trimesters, also a consulting producer, formerly the executive producer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He's a songwriter as well, wrote the songs for Colbert Christmas, The Greatest Gift of All, and the co-author of America, the Book, along with Jon Stewart. We welcome your calls and comments, questions for David Javerbaum. If you have a particular thing you'd like to know about what goes on at The Daily Show in particular, we'd welcome your questions to David. And we'll start with Patrick in San Mateo. Patrick, go ahead.
Hey, David. It's Patrick. I first want to tell you I'm a huge fan of The Daily Show, The Onion.
Thank you.
I heard in the beginning of this that you were part of The Onion before, before The Daily Show and your career in musicals. I was at the University of Wisconsin back in 88 and knew Tim Keck and The Onion back then when he first found it. I was wondering, first, if you went to University of Wisconsin-Madison, and second, what the transition was like in your career going from, you know, writing for a, you know, a paper to producing on TV and then to musicals, what were the differences?
I did not go to Wisconsin. I had a friend from my high school days who Ben Carlin, who was an incredibly, incredibly important and talented person, he went to Wisconsin. I went to Harvard. He got on, he was a staffer he became the editor, and so I worked for him. I worked there for about 3 years, and from New York, and I was temping and making money, temping at third shift law firms here in New York for a while. So I got there right when it became kind of popular, and then I was involved in the first book, Our Dumb Century, and then that got me a job. I got representation, and then that got me a job at David Letterman. That was my first job in television, and it was a transition. You know, it's just you going from writing prose to writing for something much more visual. So you just have to start thinking more visually, and I did find that a bit of a challenge because I'm more of a words person usually.
Patrick, thanks for the call. One of my old favorite headlines, I'm not sure I'll get this exactly right, from The Onion, David, was it came about when pro sports teams were always talking about moving unless they got an offer. This one was the Senate threatens to move unless they get a retractable roof on the Capitol. So.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the number of great ones goes into the tens of thousands at this point.
David Jeferbaum, our guest, Seth, is our next caller calling this morning from Nevada. Seth, go ahead.
I guess it's maybe a question or kind of comment, but I know that The Daily Show is not necessarily considered a news show, but I think that The Daily Show should take itself at least as seriously as The Tonight Show and start having guests when Jon Stewart's not available and having guests during whenever Jon Stewart wants to take a vacation, because even though it's a comedy show, it's definitely a good source of news, and I don't think there's anything else for like the next 2 or 3 weeks, so that kind of leaves a lot of people in the dark.
The problem is that when John takes a vacation, we all take a vacation. there's nobody in the office, and actually we're on vacation right now as of yesterday for the next 2.5 weeks, and we're not coming in. we're taking a break, but I mean, yeah, we always, you know, we hear that sometimes you come back from a break and people say, you know, where have you been? This happened, but the truth is there's always stuff happening, you know, there's always been stuff happening, so we'll come back and we will, you know, get right on whatever the topic of the day is.
What about, you mentioned before your early job with Letterman. You want to describe differences between the two shows or working for the two individuals?
It was a very different experience. I mean, at the time when I was Letterman, I was there for a year, and I didn't really talk to Dave more than a handful of times. It was very compartmentalized, and it's much more sort of an open ship at the Daily Show. It's really very sort of horizontally arranged so that everybody can talk to everybody else. And it was a different experience. It's much, much more friendly. I mean, that's a large part of the success of the show is that, you know, how friendly it is and what a nice place it is to work.
You mentioned Ben Carlin a moment ago. I should have attributed America, the book, to him as well.
And to John. I mean, that's right. And for that matter, also, the Colbert Christmas stuff, and we haven't talked about the guy who wrote the music, it's Adam Schlesinger, from Fountains of Wayne and from Ivy and from Tinted Windows and about 100 other incredible things. He wrote Cry Baby with Me, and he did the music for the Christmas special, and it's, you know, it's out of this world.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of shows, both the Colbert Report, but also the Daily Show. And it brings me back to something that comes from America, the book, where you write an introduction to the media and its role in democracy. I'm just going to read the first part of it. A free and independent press is essential to the health of a functioning democracy. It serves to inform the voting public on matters relevant to its well-being. Why they've stopped doing this is a mystery. I mean, 300 camera crews outside a courthouse to see what Kobe Bryant is wearing when the judge sets his hearing date. What, while false information used to send our country to war goes unchecked. What the blank happened, and on it goes. It brings me back, I guess, to what I was observing before about
that was pure John.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like pure John, because his intensity about these things really does come through, and it's brought about this rise in people who really now do turn to it as a way of getting at the news that the so-called mainstream media does not get at.
You know, we hear this a lot, you know, and my response is always that that's a reflection of other people's failure and not our success. I always feel that way, and we don't, you know, feel obligated to, you know, in any way to fulfill that obligation, because we don't see it as that, but we do sort of try to pursue our jobs in a way so that we feel kind of proud of what we do, and we have some kind of comedic integrity, and that, you know, so that if we make a joke about somebody, we do it, you know, fairly and with some kind of with evidence, you know, having built a case, you know, it's just more elegant that way from a comedic standpoint.
And one of the things you do really is pure journalism, which is you bring back what people have said in the past, often sort of juxtaposing their statements against each other. I remember, I think it was shortly after the off-year elections in Virginia and New Jersey, there were comparisons of Ari Fleischer on the one hand saying a number of years ago, oh, these off-year elections, they have no importance whatsoever. And then more recently saying they're really important. They indicate what direction America is going in, because of course Republicans were going to do well in this year's version. So that's a pure journalistic technique. I mean, it's not unlike what Tim Russert used to do on Meet the Press, is making people confront what it is they've actually said in the past.
But that's a perfect example of what I said before about other people's failures. I mean, why is nobody else doing that? I have no idea. Like, it's not our obligation to do it. So why aren't journalists doing that? I don't know. They have access to a much bigger archive of video than we do and have a whole bigger budget than we do. So
here's an observation from Hub Brown from Syracuse University's Journalism and Public Communications program. He writes, the stock and trade of The Daily Show is exposing hypocrisy, and nobody else has the guts to do it. They really know how to crystallize an issue on all sides. So another observation, again, speaking to your point about what others are not doing compared to what you do provide. Let's take another caller. Matt in Oakland joins us next. Matt, go ahead.
Hi. You know, this actually kind of follows exactly on what you're talking about. But, you know, to me, my question is, you know, what does it say about the media at this point in the history that what effectively is a satire show is now viewed as a legitimate news source? And in fact, often Trump's quote-unquote legitimate news sources, you know, and when John Stewart was interviewed on Crossfire and the flap that blew up around that, when he basically just called them on the carpet for being entertainment, you know, it was just one of those kind of wake up moments, I think. And it was just I was just interested in your thoughts on that.
Matt, thanks for the call and the observation.
Yeah, no, I would just say that, you know, it probably doesn't say good things about the media if people are taking us as the number one source. You know, I think some of the problems with the media are the problems that we try to point out about the media on our show. You know, yeah, but I'm not, you know, everybody who works at the show is a comedy writer first. You know, like, we're not political activists or not journalists. Actually, a couple of people were journalists before they came here, but not too many, really. I mean, our main job is to write jokes and do that in a way that you know, is illustrative and is pointed, and that's what we try to do.
There's a quote I'm going to read from the You Include in America, the book, a timeline of news milestones, and here's what you say about 1980. This is CNN. Ted Turner launches 24-hour news network. People doubt there will be enough news to fill 24 hours. People are right.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah, that's what happens when there's nobody operating as a filter anymore. There's nobody who feels qualified or is interested in saying this is important, this is not important, because if you say something's important, not important, then I guess you're thought of as being biased or you're actually accused of actually having a brain. So, and that's a problem. I really don't know.
It sounds like, you know, from some of what our listeners have already said, and obviously by the way in which the show is regarded, that there's an appetite for the show to be on more or to have other projects like that. Of course, Colbert is one project that came out of The Daily Show. But, you know, our earlier caller who said, how come you can't be on five nights a week? How come you can't be on when you're on vacation? And your response was, it sounds like that's very intentional, that you really don't want to be on all the time and that you take having time off seriously. Fill us in a little bit more, I guess, on why you've taken that approach as opposed to the standard we must be on all the time no matter what.
Well, we were never an 11:30 1-hour talk show. You know, we are an 11 o'clock half-hour news show, and we don't have three or four guests. You know, we have one, and so it just we just never exactly fit, you know, that template in terms of having to be there And actually, if you think about it, I mean, if a show like Letterman, I think they have as many weeks off as we do. I mean, they just show reruns. It's just that their reruns don't seem as dated because our reruns are extremely dated. You know, we have no shelf life. I mean, that's the disadvantage of what we do, is that it's very, very hot and fresh when it comes out, and then it goes stale very quickly. You know, but we're all aware of that. So it's an intense job, and, you know, we don't apologize for taking some time off now and again to recharge.
David Javerbaum, consulting producer with The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, also wrote the songs for Colbert Christmas, The Greatest Gift of All, wrote the lyrics, I should say. You also noted earlier that the music was composed by your colleague, is it Adam Schlesinger? Sorry, don't have it right in front of me.
And
also was the co-author, along with Ben Carlin and Joe and Jon Stewart, of America, the Book, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. Still a wonderful book to look at. It was done, what, 4 or 5 years ago? Still really fun.
It was done 5 years ago, 2004, and we're doing another one, and it's very hard. It's a very intense process.
Yeah, I can imagine. We welcome your calls and comments, too. If you have a question about what it's like at The Daily Show, would like to know more about what's going on with that, you can join us by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. I wanted to ask you about the criticism that's sometimes directed towards the show, towards The Daily Show, as being too liberal. And I recall one instance when after Obama was inaugurated, that on The Daily Show you did clips comparing sort of Obama's inaugural with former President Bush's and the similarities between the two speeches. So what's your feeling about the way in which, whether or not the show leans to the left, or do you make a conscious effort to make sure you sort of poke at the left just as much?
The truth is, we do make a conscious effort. I certainly think, like, you know, I think the majority, not the totality of our writing staff, is like on the same side of the issue when it comes to things like to gay marriage, you know, and abortion issues and stuff like that. I think we're all probably on the left, quote unquote, side of that. But I just think, you know, to assume that the only place from which somebody can come is from the left or the right, is that is the problem right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the problem right there. Like, it's like we come from what we consider a place of critical thinking. I mean, that's I don't mean to be like pretentious about it, but like that's how most people approach life. I think it's just that the media has lost the ability to do it. So,
you did. I didn't see this, but I did read one great line that Jon Stewart had about President Obama, which was he always looks like he's posing for a coin.
Yeah, I remember that we did the show. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it is. Bruce in Palo Alto is next. Bruce, go ahead.
Hey there. Love the show and have watched it since its inception, and I like a change that I've noted over the last year or so, and I want to get your comment about it. And back in the day with Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert and Ed Helms, you had some extremely talented people, and I know it's subjective. My view is that things changed dramatically when they left, and I didn't feel the talent level was right there, and I don't expect you to comment on that for obvious reasons. But tell me about the change in direction, which I favor, of more Jon Stewart and less of the bits and the quote-unquote correspondence, how that came about and your own view about and if there's going to be even a further change in direction as we head into 2010.
Bruce, thanks.
It's not like a conscious decision. I mean, things kind of evolve and kind of like the ebb and flow of the show in terms of what we focus on and segments that come and go have just kind of, you know, kind of ebbed and flowed naturally for the last, 10 years. You know, I obviously can tell you that I disagree with your assessment of, I mean, Stephen and Ed and Cordry, you know, they were four amazingly talented people. I think the people we have there are exactly in that category. Sam, Jason, I mean, John Oliver is extraordinary. We like using them. I used to be involved in the chats a lot, actually. So I guess now that I've scaled back a little bit, maybe we don't do as many of them as we used to. But I think the chats are still like the best part of the show to me. I love doing those.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Robbie is next in Kensington. Robbie, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say I've been watching the show for years and love it. And I also watched the Colbert Report now. And I have to say, as much as I love Jon Stewart, I am really in love with Stephen Colbert. He's just the most brilliant person I have you know, ever encountered on TV. And I was wondering what it's been like for you when you have worked with him, because it just bowls me over how brilliant he is, and how his spontaneous interviews and the material he puts out on his show, it just amazes me.
He's really good. He's exactly what you would think he is like, an incredibly sweet guy. And I got to know him when he was at The Daily Show. I worked with him, quite a bit. And then went over to, got his own show, and I worked with him on the lyrics for that special. And he's just a brilliant guy. I mean, you know, the fact that I have managed to spend the last 10 years with John and Stephen is an amazing stroke of good luck for my career. And you know, just knowing how to be a good person while also still being incredibly talented.
Robbie, thanks for the call. And it reminds me of something I read that you said in another interview, David, that part of the reason why Jon Stewart was willing to participate in the Colbert Christmas and sing a song about Hanukkah was his affection and respect for Colbert. So it sounds like their relationship is also one of great, great mutual regard.
Well, yeah. I mean, Jon is the one who, along with Ben Carlin, helped set up Stephen's show. I mean, they set up that show together. And Jon's the EP of the Colbert Report.
Holly in San Francisco. Holly, go ahead.
Yes, I'm a big fan of both Stephen and John, and I think they have a huge influence. But I think they could have a lot more influence. There are people who might watch them and actually have their minds changed if there wasn't so much crude and sexual humor. And I'm just wondering if you ever think of that your ability to reach a different audience if there wasn't so much, I think, gratuitous crudeness.
I think it probably would reach a different audience, and it might lose a certain audience. I'll be quite honest with you. Like we kind of are fans of having a little bit of that kind of humor in the show. I mean, we want to have every kind of joke in the show, the same way that The Simpsons, which is our role model for comedy, will have like every type of joke in the show, from like a broad pun to like an incredibly obscure reference to just great observations about human relationships. And, you know, so we like having a lot of different strains in there. You're probably right. We probably do lose some people, and I hope we don't lose you. I hope you keep watching. And I'll do my best to not make it any cruder than already.
Holly, thanks for the call. You mentioned earlier, David, that the people who work on The Daily Show are comedy writers first and not political activists. Are people who work on The Daily Show free to engage in whatever sort of political activity they want? And I ask the question because, of course, in journalism organizations, traditional journalism organizations, reporters, producers can't do that. They can't go out and advocate for candidates for fairly obvious reasons. I wonder if that's true in your regard, and it intrigues me in part because people do so often now get their news from you.
Well, it's a good question. The truth of the matter is usually when we're asked, you know, when the writers come to management and say, can we be involved in this, it's about, like, working on a movie. It's about working on, another creative project. It's not really about another political thing. So there's the only conflict there would just be one of, you know, a whole different set of issues. But it's not really a political thing. We don't really, you know, participate much. We're all a bunch of big losers, basically. We just go home at the end of the day and just, you know, go home to our families and our children and just, you know, kind of hide from the earth.
Kathy in Milpitas is next. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I had a question similar to the last one you just asked. You mentioned that you all are comedic writers first, but is there ever a temptation, has it ever happened, and I want to know, how do you restrain yourself when you uncover or find something, like you show those differences, hey, they said this 2 years ago, now they're saying this. Is there ever a temptation to march up to the White House or, you know, call someone and say, hey, you know, aha, we caught it. We've busted these people. How do you restrain from going after them? And on a more serious note, you know, how do you always keep it funny?
Well, we feel like that's our job. Like I said before, like we feel like it's our job. Like we're not thinking from the standpoint of how can I take this point of view and you know, change the world in the most profound way possible. We're thinking, how can we take this fact that we've uncovered and make as many people laugh as possible? I mean, that's just kind of what our job description is. So we just, you know, but when, as I said before, also, if the point is made, if we don't do it, if you do it like at the didactic point and say, doesn't, you know, if the punchline of a joke is, this is terrible, like that's not funny, that's not a joke. So, you know, we always do try to make it funny. And I think that's a reason why people like the show. I think if it was too preachy and too didactic, I think people would turn off.
There was a comment that Jon Stewart had on the program, I guess it was the night before last, on the latest Tea Party demonstration that I was mentioning, I guess, earlier. And you showed a clip from someone who gave a speech at the Tea Party event, and I can't recall who that individual was, but this person said, "We can't let the pen be mightier than the sword." And it cut from that to Jon Stewart doing his sort of classic reaction, rubber-faced sort of look. And then he went on to say, I thought that having the pen be mightier than the sword was the actual basis for civilization. So, I mean, you do go after people. You do make that point. But it is within the context of this is funny and this is painful and this is intense. I mean, it's all of those things.
Yeah, it's all those things. We actually have a running joke on the show among the writers that we'll write a stage description saying John gives knowing look. That's the stage direction.
Ryan in Dallas, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I've been a big fan for about 5 years or so of both shows, and I was just curious specifically on like the Colbert Report. If you had any knowledge of how much of it is actually what Colbert is writing himself and saying, and how much of it is the writers or producers?
It's exactly like it is at our show. Like he is the overall the head writer of all head writers and the EP of all the EPs, and you know everything passes through his hands and his eyes. So he's writing a lot of the stuff. They have an amazing writing staff over there, led by I have a new head writer there now, but it's a great bunch of writers, and so they all work very well with him, and our writers work very well with John. And but you know John and Stephen are sort of like the front men of the whole thing, just like you know Letterman would be or Leno or Conan or all those guys.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Yeah, how much of it is collaborative? You mentioned earlier when I quoted something, you said that's pure John. Are they stitched together each contributions and or how much of it? I mean, it seemed to me hard to write a joke in a group, but walk us through who does what.
It's a really complicated and evolving process, but you know the process of the show is the thing that we actually kind of talk about the most. You know, behind the scenes, you know the process of putting a show together. But it's a lot of interaction with the writers of the show and the producers of the show, who are the people who spend you know all their time watching TV and like looking, you know, making connections visually, who are like you know among the unsung heroes of the show. And they work very closely now with the writers, and then with John and with our two EPs now, Josh Lieb and Rory Albanese, and our head writer now, Steve Bodo. And they have a script put together by about 2, and then we'll rehearse at 4. And after the rehearsal, a lot gets changed in that frantic hour, or, you know, between rehearsal and the actual taping. But if you've had a good day and a focused day, then all we're doing at that point is writing jokes, which in some ways is the easiest thing to do at the last minute, is to write jokes as opposed to having to restructure an entire story.
Here's another caller who wants a question about sort of the process of putting together the show. Henry in San Francisco. Henry?
Oh, hi. Mr. Javabam, I'm a huge fan, and I have a question about the interviews on The Daily Show. How much of it is edited? Because some of the questions that are presented are incredibly, controversial, and I'm just wondering what's the extent of the editing?
Well, they are edited sometimes. They're edited for length. Something goes, we often have somebody on with whom John is very interested in having a long conversation, and you should just go to the website the next day because you'll see the entire unedited one. We edit it just for length to fit into the show. We occasionally will edit something out if somebody you know makes a terrible mistake or something, but almost never. We almost never you know feel like we can't show something because even though the interviews get very intense, they tend not to get personal. We you know John tries to keep it on the level of you know. Disagreeing with someone's ideas rather than them personally, and I think it's another thing people have responded to over the years with John's interviews is that you know usually with you know rare exceptions they're very civil and they're very pleasant even though there's a great deal of disagreement.
David, we're coming to the end of our hour. Give us an update on the next book project. You've referenced it. When you hope it will come out, what it's going to be like, or a line or two from it, if you so choose.
It's still a little hush-hush. It's going to be out for the next Christmas season, And it is, I'll just say that it's the natural sequel to America the Book, and it is very hard to write, but I think you'll be hearing more about it in a few months to come.
Speaking of America the Book, I'll conclude by just reading a review that was you put in of not so much of America the Book, but of the Constitution itself. This is from the Wilmington Gazette Current Chronicle. John Jay writes, "This follow-up to the Articles of Confederation is the rare sequel that's more bicameral than the original. Gallop, don't trot to your town square to pick up a copy." So I hope people will gallop and not trot to whatever that book is and when it comes out next.
Yeah, or jet ski.
David Jefferbaum has been our guest this hour. His book is called What to Expect When You're Expected, A Fetus's Guide to the First Three Trimesters, written by David Jefferbaum. Oh, I didn't ask you this one thing. I have to ask you this real quick. There's this running gag throughout the book of Antonio Banderas' picture, including on the back. You are under the picture of Antonio Banderas. What was that all about?
It was nothing more than something I thought was funny. It has nothing to do with anything. I mean, it's just something I thought was funny. I've never seen anybody put out a book where the author picture is clearly somebody else. I thought that was a funny joke.
It is. David Jefferbaum. Thanks for being with us, David. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Larberg, and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer, Danny Bringer. The executive producer of Forum is Ramul Ramirez. And a reminder that you can continue this conversation on our website. Just go to kqed.org/forum. You click on this show, and then you can add your comments. That's where you can continue the conversation. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Stephen Colbert.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.